You're listening to 103.5 FM WCOMLP Chapel Hill Cobbler, your community radio station. Estás escuchando a 103.5 FM WCOMLP Chapel Hill Cobbler.
Welcome to the Christmas Eve edition of the Boomer Beat here on WCOM. I'm your host, Beverly Mahone, and yeah, I've been away from you for a couple of weeks dealing with some type of virus in the air, but I'm back, and today we've got a very special show for you. It's all about getting in the spirit of the holiday season, but we want you to get in the spirit and continue into the new year. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce my guest today, although he's not going to be on just yet, but I want to let you know that Daryl Lester is here, and he is going to be talking about philanthropy. And even if you can't spell the word, that's okay. It's an easy thing to do, okay? It's not as hard as it might sound. It's a very easy thing to do. And so we'll be talking with Daryl in just a few minutes. You are listening to the Boomer Beat here on WCOM with your host, Beverly Mahone. And my very special guest today is social entrepreneur and community philanthropist, Daryl K. Lester. And first of all, I want to welcome you to the show, Daryl. And I am so delighted to finally meet you in person, because I've read about you, but it's nice to put words with a face.
Thank you, Beverly. Glad to be here.
Well, now, social entrepreneur. Okay. What is that?
Basically, you know, what we're saying is folks who want to make a living and want to have a profit in a business also think about how they can make a difference in the community. I think the overall society may call it social entrepreneurship, but I think there are lots of folks out here who work in a for-profit world, but always think about how they may take their profits and give back to make the community better. I think we're blessed in the Triangle to have, like, at Duke has a center on social entrepreneurship, and a lot of we have this group called Bull City Forward that's in Durham talking about that. And what I try to do is let people know that folks are doing it. It's not all. It didn't always have to be that sophisticated. That I think it's even though the term is social entrepreneurship, I think everybody seeks to make a difference, whether they work in the nonprofit sector or I work in the for-profit sector. And we just try to be more intentional about how we define that we want to be a company that was seen as giving back and making a difference at the same time.
So is that why you refer to yourself as a community philanthropist?
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because when you think of philanthropists, mm-hmm. you really do think of the Bill Gates,
yes.
the Buffets,
yes.
You think of those names.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't ever put, like, community yes. with philanthropy.
Yeah, yeah.
So explain that concept.
Well, you know, it broadens the definition of philanthropy to include one's time, one's resources that may not be one's money that they give to. And so when you put it in front of philanthropy, it changes the whole definition of what the word is. Even though I think people are socialized to see that the Gates, the Buffets, the Oprahs, the Cosbys are the ones that can be philanthropic. And part of my journey since I've been living has been, how do I change people's definition or psychology of what they think a philanthropist is? Because people are doing it, but I think what we see on TV is sometimes the person that may have given a significant sum of money to a group that seems to be of need. But for folks who do it on a daily basis, they don't necessarily term it or call it philanthropy, but they are giving. You know, I think 10 or 11 years ago, in the field of philanthropy, nobody was saying time, talent, and treasure. Now they're saying, oh, I hear people in those walls and boardrooms of foundation saying, oh, philanthropy is time, talent, and treasure. So I think we've seen enough examples of now where I think when Osceola McCarthy, the lady in Hattiesburg in Mississippi, who was a dishwoman, left $150,000 to the University of Southern Mississippi, people were like, huh, how did she do that? But we have grandparents, aunts and uncles who tuck money away and are really thrifty. And because of what they stand for, they decided that long after they're gone, wow, I made a difference that makes have some young person inroads to education. So we decided we wanted to demystify philanthropy, and that's the tagline for my company. Because if we can demystify it, more people will walk into the space saying, I may not have as much as the next person, but I do have something that I can give back. And if we can get more people walking in that space, I think our communities will become a lot better.
Your company is called Hindsight Consulting,
yes.
And which you started in early 2000. Uh-huh. Hindsight means, like, you know, in hindsight, Yes. You know, I should have done this or I could have done this.
Yes.
So now explain the name of the company and how it relates to what you're doing.
Yeah. So, you know, working in the field, you know, philanthropy, and I've seen it from a lot of different angles. I worked in higher education and then found myself working in a foundation. And I thought that it was always good for people to be reflective. And so when they say hindsight is 2020, we said we wanted to help people be reflective. But our first logo was a Sankofa bird, which was an Ndinkra symbol that meant that the bird is always facing forward, the body, but its head is turned backwards, recognizing you got as you go forward, you always got to look back and get the best of what you got and bring it forward. Mm. So that was our first logo that we had because it was a piece, and I'm a big history buff. And so when I started looking at what the Ndinkra symbols meant, I said, wow, this applies to my, so I got some young graphic designers down in Birmingham to do my first logo. They took the Sankofa bird and jazzed it up a little bit. But if we could get people to be more reflective, and there's these questions I use around my work. The first question is, who am I? Where have I been? Why am I here? Where am I going? What contribution do I want to make? And I think as folks, whether they're young or old, are going through their life journey, if they start to look at those questions, it gives them a sense that I just wasn't put here just to, you know, live and breathe. That at some point, that dash between what people are going to see when they take me home, I control what that is. People are not going to remember that I drove a big car or I had a large house, but they will remember how you treated people and what you left in place. And so we wanted to be a company that actually helped people to unpack that. And it wasn't about whether they worked a certain place or whether they lived a certain place or they came from a pedigree. We just said to people that everybody is a giver. And so we have to think about how do we maximize everybody's gifts.
Well, what impresses me is the fact that you are surrounded by a bevy of young people.
Yes.
Not to say you're old, but, you know, I mean, we're boomers. So,
right, right.
But you're surrounded by a group of young people and the fact that they are all in various parts of the country. Mm-hmm. How did you pull all of them together? And what was the pitch?
Yeah. Well, you know, in 2001, when I transitioned out of what I'd call, I always say the foundation, where I call it institutional philanthropy, organizations that are in the business of giving. When I transitioned out of that and started looking at a consulting space, I had an opportunity to work closely with a lady who was a program officer at the Ford Foundation, who and her portfolio was beginning to look at the American South and how many groups of color, primarily African American, were doing in the South. And so as she laid out her portfolio, she was really trying to figure out how do we lift up those traditions of giving in our community to better address issues in our community. And so we had an opportunity to work in that portfolio, and we spent a year traveling throughout the South, talking to young, in this particular case, young African-Americans, young adults, about when you think about your time, talent, and treasure, how do you use those to better your community? So spending that year, and then after that year, she sat me down and said, well, what would you do with what you heard? I said, well, I'd go back. And I'd organize in those communities, those groups of individuals, so they could act collectively. And at that time, I grew up in Marion, South Carolina, and, you know, we shared flour, sugar, water. People opened up their doors. So what I learned, Beverly, is that if we're going to move the needle on this giving, we might want to make it be connected to something that was that we already did. We already came together when people were in crisis. What we did was we decided to organize people's time, talent, and treasure, but put an organizational twist on it. We asked them, when you pool your resources, instead of putting it in a checking account or letting it exist somewhere, let's now bridge the gap between what we know happens at community level and what we know happens at institution. So there are tools over here that certain people get access to, donor advised funds, charitable funds, scholarship funds. And we decided that this group should be using one of those tools so that when people talk philanthropy in communities, the table changes. Now when, for example, when the Triangle Community Foundation has its annual gathering, wow, the philanthropists become a little diverse. And that means that the opportunity for all givers to be at the same table are important. And so this giving circle model, which was an old model with a new twist, we started using that to organize givers and donors in our community. What we found is that in the early 90s, it was starting to get a lot of press in the national scene. The women's giving circles were really big. There was a group out of Washington, D.C. that was producing a lot of reports. So a good friend of mine and I, we were in D.C., and we decided to go to this meeting that we were not invited to. So we went to the meeting.
Those are the best ones.
Yes. So, you know, make a long story short, we went to this meeting to let folks know this giving circle thing that you're talking about didn't originate when institutional philanthropy said, oh, we have giving circles. In communities where people have had barriers, they've always used collective giving as a survival tool. And now that maybe now people don't face those same barriers, they're still giving in a certain way, which is how it shapes their philanthropy now. So we launched the Community Investment Network in 2005, and it became its own 501c3. And what we decided that those young people who were part of those giving circles should be the board. So a few of those folks came onto the board, and now they have, it's run by a young man named Chad Jones. And it's a pretty virtual organization, too, because it's not top heavy because all the work we know happens on the local level. There are 15 giving circles in that network. It stretches from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, all the way down to Louisiana. Then it's gone to the Midwest not too long ago with a group of African-American gentlemen who created the giving circle. But what we find is the giving circle tool is an on-ramp for people to get engaged in more strategic giving without saying, I got to have big money to play.
There's a misnomer, oh, I believe it's a misnomer, in the African-American community and even in the other communities mm-hmm. that we as Black people really don't give mm-hmm. and that, you know, we either don't have it or, as you said earlier off mic, is that we're always on the receiving end of it. Yes. And when we do give, we really just give to the church mm-hmm. and we mm-hmm. don't really go beyond mm-hmm. that. So mm-hmm. what are you doing in order to dispel mm-hmm. that misnomer? Because I believe it is a misnomer.
Yes, it is. It is. I think, you know, when you look at a lot of the mainstream tools that people use to measure one's philanthropy, I think African-American and other groups are not, some of them, we're not using those tools as well as other folks are. So when we go to capture data and all that, it's not showing up in the data. But what I will say, I used to tell my friends who worked in institutional philanthropy is that, so when if you look at this report, the Chronicle of Philanthropy put out a report in 2003 that talked about race was a powerful influence on giving. Well, they looked at who was giving the most discretionary income. Well, groups of color were giving a significant amount of the discretionary income, but we know where that was going, to the church. So what we've been trying to do is, how do you get people to give, let tithing be their floor and not their ceiling? And getting them to think about, well, I know you give to your church. It's great if your church or other faith institution is very externally oriented. But if it's not, we have to start tinkering, because for those of us who run nonprofit organizations or out there doing trench work 5 days a week, they will probably say, they may not always be public about it. They'll say, well, I don't mess with them because they don't give. Why do I need to cultivate them? But I think history has shown us when Osceola McCarthy gave $150,000 to the university, there are lots of community philanthropists out there who are getting passed over. People don't ask them as much because they don't show up in the data that people produce that they are givers. So if we can kind of, we said if we can flip the script and get folks to realize that philanthropy belongs to nobody, but based on my own time, talent, and treasure, I have the ability to give, and that because you give your tithe, you got to think about your child might be benefiting from a nonprofit, from an after-school program. We have to start going up the ladder and say, wow, I may only have $5 or $10, but that $5 or $10 might make a difference to that organization that my child benefits from, or my cousin. Or so we're getting them to, and that's not an easy bridge to cross. It takes a lot of tilling on the ground. It's reminding people that in history, what we're doing now, we did yesterday. So it's trying to, a lot of it is our culture. What does our cultural memory tell us about how we gave and how we took care of each other?
And I think, Daryl, that there are some people who give to the church who believe that, well, I've given my tithes, so this is my part of giving, without really checking to see what the church is really doing with that money.
Yes.
And if you, I don't think it's a sin. If you don't, if your church isn't giving any, doing any extended outreach, then why are you giving your money to the church? Find some other way to give.
That's right.
And I could really go on a soapbox
but
I will not.
We could unpack that one, couldn't we?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah. But anyway, we won't do that right now. You are listening to the Boomer Beat here on WCOM with my very special guest today, community philanthropist and social entrepreneur Daryl K. Lester. And we're talking about giving your time, your treasure, your talent. And before we went to break, I said to you that I thought that, you know, philanthropy, I guess as I understand it, has always been about money, but it really isn't. Mm-mm. It's beyond that.
Yes.
So can you explain to the listeners what that means when you talk about your time and your treasure as it relates to philanthropy?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think when you look at the just the Webster's definition, we're talking about the love of humankind. And it's interesting how we've gotten from the love of humankind to the giving of big money to those perceived as wanting. And, you know, I think it's really about living a life of relevance. You know, and how, if people think they're relevant, they'll show up with their time, their talent, and whatever they have in a certain way. I'm a believer, Beverly, that on a daily basis, we get an opportunity to make a difference somehow. When we're traveling to work sometime, we might look over and we see somebody stranded on the side of the road. I think we all, sometimes it pricks us. It's like, do I stop today? What do I do? And I think those are the little micro moments that we have. And I think if you don't deal with those, it's hard for people to get to the level of giving any treasure. So I am a big believer that when people show up with their time and talent, it helps them to better understand what they should be doing with their treasure. Whether and that treasure could be some old clothes that you have, or some clothes that you feel that you've had too much of, or you got a closet that's overflowing. That now I can say, you know, I have an abundance. Now let me take some of that. Lynn Twist has a book called The Soul of Money, and she says that most of us have to get to a place that we have a legacy of enough. And I think for me, I got to the point where, you know what, do I need any more stuff? And once I think people get that, they start deciding that, well, maybe I can get some psychic rewards out of giving to somebody else. And it does make people really excited, which is why during this season, there's a lot of giving going on, right? Now, people are going to push me when I say this, but when we give during those seasonal things, it does make us feel good. But the issues that we think we're addressing continue after the holiday season. So how do we get people to stay engaged in the issue and realize that sometime when I volunteer, that's about me. It's not necessarily about the other person, because it makes me feel so good that I gave something back. But if I go upstream and I say, wow, did my volunteerism there make a difference? So I have to start thinking, what else can I do? And that's when I think once we give it enough time and talent, we start saying, wow, that organization gave me an opportunity to give back and to volunteer. Can I now make a sacrifice and give them something out of my treasure to help them? Yeah. So I think the more engaged people get with that time and talent, they start to see how what they think is a little bit can make some big ripples. And that is what, so I'm a big, I'm a, I always say my friend who are in the business of they professional fundraisers. I said, the best ones are the ones who are givers. They know what it's like to give. So when they know that when they go ask somebody, they know what the process is like. So they understand both sides of the coin. And I think that all of us on this earth are on both sides of that coin. There's sometime we're going to be givers. Sometime we're going to be receivers. And I think as we understand that journey, I think we better understand that this word that's so big that people can't sometimes pronounce is not that way. If you define, you got to define it for yourself. I think Eckhart Tolle in his book, he talked about, does living a life of abundance have anything to do with all the stuff I got stored up? He said, no, it's about just how you show up. You know, I lived in a neighborhood growing up in South Carolina where everybody, regardless of income, was on the same street. Now what I come to learn, which was public housing and all that, but we all lived together. And when Christ had happened, we all addressed the issue together. Mm-hmm. We didn't put any boxes or silos up for folks. And I think to me, I think, and I'll say this is, you know, when Carter G. Woodson in his book said that when you control a person's thinking, you don't have to worry about his actions. You don't have to make him go to the back door. He'll go to the back door without being told. I think people's perception and thinking around what they think it is drives how they act upon it. So if I start walking into space that, hey, I am a giver, I'm going to show up that way. That means that when I see people, I'm going to speak to them, because to me, speaking to people brings people into your presence. And I think so there's a micro things that we could do that are not about the giving of big money. They're not about showing up to some event. It's about some little things we do each day, starting within our house, then extending out, that it can make us all givers and philanthropists. And so I think when people really get it, they'll be so excited. And, you know, the research has shown that people who are giving psychologically are happier. They're better people because of that. So I always say, give me somebody that ain't feeling good about living and ain't, you know, okay, start helping somebody else out and watch how it might change their psyche.
And I believe that. Yeah. I mean, even in the smallest things, and I'm going to just share a quick story with you. There was a day, it was an early morning, and I was in the parking lot of one of the local shopping out malls. Mm-hmm. And lady and I were both going for the, I guess we're going for the same spot. Mm-hmm. Well, she cut in, you know, and everything. Okay, fine. I'll just go park somewhere else. Well, when she got out of the car, our eyes met, and she looked like she was ready to just attack me, but she got the space. So mm-hmm. I was like, okay, I'm not sure what's going on here, but she might be having a bad morning. So I said to her, she was a young girl. I said, honey, I said, you are such a pretty girl. You should smile. Mm-hmm. You know, I said, come on now. It's a good morning. You got the space you mm-hmm. wanted. So smile. So for whatever reason, she did. Mm-hmm. And I thought at that moment, that's all she needed. Mm-hmm. She needed some, whatever was going on was not about me. Mm-hmm. Didn't have anything to do with me.
Right. That's right.
But when you can do something mm-hmm. as small as just offer a smile,
yes.
open a door.
Yes.
Those things mean a lot too.
Yes. Yes.
And on the other end of the scale, Daryl, you know, wouldn't you say that philanthropy really just goes way beyond, and I was probably just repeating myself, but way beyond just the giving, because there are people that mm-hmm. just do nothing but give.
Yes.
They mm-hmm. don't, I mean, give money.
Yes.
They don't uh-huh. give time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't give talent. Mm-hmm. They just give money.
Yes.
And I don't know if that's really philanthropy
yes.
or not.
Yes. You know, so I'm gonna share this story to respond to that. So the giving circle that I was a part of helped a group that was a part of the Housing for New Hope in Durham. And these group, they had formed an alumni group of folks who were formerly homeless. And we had a chance to meet this gentleman. His name is Alfonso Williams. And Alfonso passed a few years ago. But we had a chance to interact and meet with him. And they were going to D.C. to do some advocacy around homelessness issues. So our giving circle was in a space to provide some travel expenses and lodging expenses for them. So when they came back, we all got together in one of my friend's houses in Durham. And as we were having a conversation, I thought to myself, I said, wow, there's several people in here who've never been homeless, and there's several people in here who have been homeless. I said, how often do we tear down the barriers between those that we are the recipient of our, quote, largesse? And I think there's where the crossroad is. How do we get people to be more connected to the folks who are recipients of it, so they don't still look at those folks as, I'm giving to you, but you know what? You're still not equal as a human as I am. I think there lies where we need to go, because I think what we find out is that sometimes we may have used the gift, as I find it, as a transaction, but the lesson is deeper than that. If I get closer to those folks who are struggling, who are trying, I start to realize, their journey was might be different than mine, but maybe now what they need is not my resources, it's sometimes my relationships and my connections that I have. And I think, you know, if people are honest, they want to give to it, but they want to stay really distant from it. And, you know, I don't like make any personal judgment, but I think if folks got a little closer to the recipients, I think we can, you know, I had a friend that says, you know, those of us who are disconnected and who are out there don't really sometimes have the network, like those of us who are in the know. So what happens if we start to share our network and open up doors for folks who are struggling? Maybe their circumstances will change. It may not be just me giving them something, but let them learn how to do it for themselves.
Yes, exactly. All right. So then you have some event that's going to be coming up in January where like everybody's going to get to sit at the table.
Yes.
So tell us about that event.
Well, you know, it really started with, so the local community foundation here is where we've some of the giving circles have their funds present there. And there's a circle there called the Beehive Collective. And I'm a part of the next generation of African-American philanthropists. And I used to know this young lady. And we said, you know, we're way past due of bringing these circles together that come across affinity. You know, so there's a group of us that come together because we all happen to be African-American and young. And then some of those groups who are diverse, strive to be diverse, still only have members that look like themselves. So we were intentional that we wanted to create a space for we all can talk apples and not oranges. So we decided that we would identify the circles that existed within the state of North Carolina, which there is a lot.
Are there really?
Yes, from the women's giving circles that are connected to community foundations who have 150 women who are part of it. They're big in the triangle. There's the Art of Giving. Then there's some of the larger women's groups. But then you have groups like the group that I know that's in Warrington, which is a group of quilters who come together to quilt. But then they care about education in Warrington, so they created a cultural tour as a giving circle to help people understand that if you come here to teach, you got to understand where the children are coming from as well. So they didn't give a grant. They created a space for people to learn. So how powerful is it going to be that these different giving circles that come across racial, ethnic, and cultural lines come in the same space to talk philanthropy when Heather and I decided that, wow, let's try to do this. And since it hadn't been done, and it's going to be January the 26th from 8:30 to 4:30. It's going to be at the Junior Lee Center for Community Leadership in Raleigh. And we've gotten a few sponsors. And the gentleman who's speaking, his name is Eugene Cho. He's an Asian guy from Seattle. And he created a movement called One Day's Wages. And he was so moved when he went to this village years ago around how this little bit of money to provide a teacher to be in a village. And he came back, he and his wife, and decided they were going to downsize their life. And he has a powerful story. And so he's coming to the triangle to speak, because I think that when people realize it's not macro, it's micro, that will make a difference in changing the community. So this group is for groups who call themselves giving circles, folks that are in collective giving groups but don't call themselves giving circles. Then they're for those groups who historically have been doing what I call membership, but they've been collectively giving. So it might be a fraternity or sorority. It could be Masons, Eastern Stars. We want all those folks in this space because we don't want to create another term called giving circles and it excludes people who we know have been doing it for years. What it does do is get us all in there talking about what we've learned and how we can be more better at it.
That's awesome. Yeah. Now let's talk about Hindsight Consulting, because you created this in 2001. Mm-hmm. Your intention behind creating it was?
Well, one is, help people think about their time, talent, and treasure in an effective way to as it relates to making communities better.
But when I think of consulting, I think of you're consulting, helping me do something.
Yes, yes.
So what services do you provide?
One is I think we do, we better say philanthropic coaching. So
you have to be coached?
Yeah, you gotta, let's say this, we got to be nudged a little bit,
oh,
right?
Okay.
We can nudge you a little bit. Nudge, guided
gotcha,
a little bit, steered.
Gotcha.
And because I played basketball in college, when Town and Country did the article years ago, they termed me the coach. And I started thinking about it, I said, wow. And I have a counseling and psychology background. So what I was trying to help people do is let's take an assessment of what you think you have. And it's for those groups who are at a space that, girl, we want to give back in some form or fashion. Well, historically, people first thing people do is what? I want to start a 501c3 organization.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, we allow people to see here's the continuum that you have. I can start a 501c3. I might want to start a donor advised fund or a charitable fund. I might want to be involved. If I'm involved in United Way, I might want to do my United Way giving, or I might start a private foundation. But then we put Giving Circle on the end over there because we wanted people to realize you have more options than just create your own 501c3. Because when you start that, you got to sustain it. So
right.
One is, how do you understand the tools to give back? And we started looking at the tools that people had, and we said, I'm not going to talk to you as if you can't use the tool, because that's what happens in the field of philanthropy. We say, I don't think I can really talk to you about using this donor advised fund because it really takes some resources to create. Well, what we decided that we're going to talk to everybody about it. Let them decide on where they want to enter the game of philanthropy. Allow them to choose where they are. So right at that point, they might be trying to decide on how I can design a good volunteer effort. And then they say, well, Daryl, I never knew about this thing called a donor advised fund or charitable fund. Who has them? Who can help me start one? What does it take to start one? Then we begin to break it down that there are institutions in our communities, there are community foundations, there are private market, you know, Merrill Lynch, Fidelity, Solomon Smith Barney, all those folks allow people to do some type of charitable fund, but not everybody can play at that level. So we have to say, okay, if you look at the continuum and the options, which one works for you? And we do this for individuals, groups, families, and sometimes for small corporations to help them think about. So you have a workforce. How do you help them think about how they give back? Some of them might want to go and volunteer, but what would happen if some of those employees wanted to create their own giving circle and give together? So we just wanted to give people more options that sometimes the ordinary person may not have had. And we realized that it's that way because, unfortunately, the institutions that are in the business of giving sometimes are looking at your index of salary. And I'm going to give you information based on what I think you have. Like I go look for a car. When I go up in a lot, do I get shown the hoopty? Or do I get shown the high-profile car? So philanthropy is like that, too. Do I lay you at the table and say, you know, Beverly, here's how people play in this field. Which one works for you or your group or your family?
Oh,
and
okay.
And I think that is. And so we spend time talking to the individuals, organization, the corporation. But then we also work within the field of philanthropy to get them to say, you know, it would be great if you had some different types of folks on your board. How about, you know, have some young people on your board and diversify that board some that it reflects the community a little better. And that's one. And then the pipeline into the field. How do we get more folks who come from the quote, quote, the receiving side of the sector onto the supply side of the sector? One, that means staff needs to change sometime. How do we get more folks that are diverse into the field? So we play in that field too. So we don't just try to get people outside of that to give. We're also saying, if these folks are getting ready to think about how they give back, the institutions who are in the business of it got to think about how they can change as well. And I'll say this, it's like the elephant and the giraffe story. So the elephant and giraffe, good friends. So the giraffe says he's going to invite the elephant into the house because he's homeless. So when he invites him into the house, he breaks up everything because he bumps into the walls and he crushes this. And then the giraffe has to think about, do I keep him in or do I escort him out? So I think in this field of giving, we got to recognize that there are people coming into this space who have a different perception. Do we ostracize them and marginalize what they're doing, or do we embrace them and say, you know what, that's good. You're doing something with your 5 or 10, but one day you might have more than 5 or 10. How do we get you to think about that as well, as well as your time and talent? Because I think for a lot of folks, they're not being asked to volunteer. So the research says, if I'm asked to volunteer, what follows? I might give as well. So helping the philanthropic sector to be more democratic, allow more people to play, is an end goal for Hindsight Consulting. That now we have community foundations that now have these giving circles of young people, you know, these young people are of color. Now when they have their annual meeting, we come, and now the room, everybody, all these different types of philanthropists are in the same space talking together. And if it doesn't happen at the giving circle level, it's not going to happen. Because to me, most times they're more informal. So how powerful is it going to be in January 26 when the group from Heritage Quilters in Warrington come together with the big giving group in Charlotte, come together with the young people's group in some other place, and they're all sitting in the same space talking, here's how we do collective giving. I think it's going to be powerful.
It sounds like it will be. Yeah. And the fact that you're not ignoring those organizations, those traditional organizations, sororities and fraternities, you know, Delta Sigma Theta, who
I'm an Omega.
All right. So, you know, about giving and the AKAs as well.
Yes.
So it's all about, okay, I love that. Everybody coming to the table to represent. Something else that I saw on your website is that you do fundraising counseling. Now, I guess maybe I should have come to you before I did my own fundraiser. But well, how do you counsel someone on fundraising?
Well, we first, you know, getting people to start from within first, then go out. So getting people to take some assessment of what is it that do I have? So if I create a nonprofit, and I get pushed on by my friends when I say this, that sometimes when we start a nonprofit and we don't know what it feels like to make our own investment, time, talent, and treasure, when you go out to ask somebody else, you know, like you haven't made that sacrifice yourself. So we try to get folks to say, make your investment. And so as you go out to talk to other folks, then you better feel what sacrifice has to be made. I flip the script on the fundraising piece on people. I'm a big believer that you gotta be a giver first. You know, I think there's the book that's out that's called The Go Giver.
Yes, by Bob Berg, and I've interviewed him in the past. Yes.
So, you know, one of his first principles is that you give first, right?
Right.
I do think I'm a big believer, and my parents taught me this way, that you reap what you sow, son. So if you're sowing some good stuff, you're gonna reap it. As for people who are in the business of fundraising, I do have to know what it feels like to be a giver. And when I it's interesting that in the professional fund development world, we make it such a heady business. When I go sit down and talk to you, if I'm trying to raise money for you, maybe I need to find out what makes you tick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think if more people did that, they'll start to realize. And we size up people in the fundraising world. We say, he's driving a hoopty. Do I really want to go talk to him? Does he have anything? Does he or she have anything to give? So there's a group called the Grassroots Fundraising Institute that I think does some interesting things of helping people to realize you can raise resources within your own community. And so we take this concept of, of working from the inside out, getting people to know that if I'm going to be a fundraiser, what is it like for me? What does my own giving look like? And I think three, how do we help them understand how the fundraising, I'm going to call it a game. How does it work? So do I know where money comes from? When I go to approach a foundation or something, do community foundations funds come into just like the Z. Smith Reynolds Foundation does? Two different types of money. So if I'm going to raise money in a sector, let me understand how to connect the dots in the sector.
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes. See, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So
it's not, I think smaller organizations don't get their fair shake of good fundraising counsel because they can't afford it. So who helps them to demystify the world of fundraising? I have some friends who work in that world who will give their time to smaller grassroots organizations because they know they don't get the same level of counsel to do it. Now, I would say, too, though, that there's some groups that when people start their organization, they haven't really gone and done any mapping or research to figure out who else is doing what I do. So sometimes we need some partnering of organizations, some collaboration going on versus let me put my stake in the ground and I'm going to go find this grant. And they're not realizing that you have a passion that's addressing a need. 10, 15 other people have the same thing, and we're all going after the same people. So to bring it back to the philanthropy piece, if we broaden the philanthropic pie, that means that we got more people to ask versus let's go ask the 10 big givers that we think give. So those who are fundraising have to expand their own vision of who can give. And I may cultivate you for a long time. You may say, no, I still don't want to give. But you never know. Once you got me as an individual, you got me, right? With the foundation, sometimes they may say, well, we changed our fundraising, my funding priorities this year. And you might be in this year, but you might be out next year.
Right. So, that happens too.
So cultivating individuals sometimes is the best place. And I'll use this example on that and let you get to the next question. So my daughter was involved in a therapeutic writing program. And they were just getting going. We were on the grass, on the ground floor. So they were thinking about land and all that. So as they started to grow it, when they started thinking about fundraising, they were thinking about people outside of them. I said, what about the parents who received a benefit from your service? Ask them first. Hmm. And I think, and what happens in this fundraising world is that those who are seen as the recipients, are people self-select for them. They can't give because they're receiving.
Oh, yeah. Give, and they would probably be the ones who would want to give.
Give everybody a chance to give. Don't self-select and say, well, I'm not going to ask them because I don't think. Let them say, you know what? You know, I like some of my friends. Yeah, Derek, where did you think I could give that? Well, the mere fact that I thought I could ask you should say something about I didn't put you in a box.
Right.
And I think those in the fundraising world have to begin to do that. That some of those folks who are recipients of their services.
Mm, I never even thought about that. Yeah. That makes so much sense. Yeah.
But you'll get pushed on in the sector when you start to do that because they even just for them to be able to give anything back. My mom always told me there. I know people may be down and out, but I learned when I watched Alphonso Williams in the group, and they were still going out. They were formerly homeless. They were still going out serving other people who were homeless. Mm. And I'm like, you know, if folks who had the perception of nothing felt they have something to give, what about those of us who feel we have something?
Right.
We're not worrying about where we're going to eat the next day. We have our heat on in our house. Yes. We have clothes. I said we have that privilege to think about how we can give back in a way that sometimes other people don't. But I don't dismiss the fact that the person that I may give something that's on the street asking me for something, I don't dismiss their capacity to be able to give something back either.
Mm, I love that. Well, gee, I could go on another hour with you because this is such a great discussion. Time is running out here. So tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more about philanthropy or the services you offer or just sitting at the table on January 26th.
Okay. The for us, get in contact with Hindsight Consulting. Our web address is hindsightconsulting.org. So www.hindsightconsulting.org. And the giving network, the community investment network is communityinvestment.org. The gathering that's coming up on January 26th has a and I always have to remember the it's ncgiving.org. And but there will be links on my site as well as the Community Investment Network site as well. If you want to reach me by email, it's I'll give you the easiest one. It's called giveback1985@gmail.com. That's giveback1985@gmail.com.
Okay, well, there you have it. This is just like just a very educational and enlightening discussion for me today as someone who does like to give back. I mean, and I agree with you about, you know, until you are able to give or to volunteer to do something, then the monetary part of it just, I don't think will really come. You got to know what it's like to just. So thank you so much for this
interview.
Thank you, family.
Happy holidays to you.
Thank you.
Blessings to your family.
Thank you so much. Well, you know what, folks? You have an opportunity to be a go-giver, too, with this station. Yes, that's right. As Daryl has said, you can gather a small group of people and help WCOM raise $2,500 to match grant funding for the renovation of its production studio and to replace the brown paper that we kind of see as our window shade. If you ever come to the station, you can help us do that. So you can make a $10 a month recurring donation, or you can send us a check for $120 for the year. And you can just give back your, you know, so many of us give our time and our talents, and yes, some of us give our treasures too, and we'd like you to be a part of that giving to WCOM. We thank you so much for tuning in, and next week, hopefully I will be here. I will be traveling in a couple of days, but next week we should have Leslie Flowers coming in to talk with us about goal setting for 2013 and beyond. So I'm looking forward to having Leslie on the show again. She was my guest last year around this time, and she's always entertaining and full of information. Until next time, I want to leave you with this. You have gifts to give the world, so find your voice and prosper. Happy New Year. Merry Christmas.